Max Marshall is an investigative journalist who, in the last few months, put out his very first book. It's called Among the Bros, a fraternity crime story. It's all about a drug trafficking ring gone horribly wrong. It includes death, it includes a murder, and a whole lot more. And I don't normally give this preface before these sorts of conversations, but there are a lot of spoilers in this conversation. So if you want to read the story, not knowing exactly what's going to happen, because Max does a great job of laying it out, including providing some surprises throughout, I do recommend you go buy Among the Bros, read that, and then come back and listen to this conversation. Having said all of that, it's my pleasure now to welcome Max to the show. Max, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
Can't complain. How are you?
I am doing great, and I'm really happy to get to talk to you. This was a gripping book, just an excellent piece of investigative journalism. And based on your own words, you didn't necessarily realize what you were going to uncover when you initially started pursuing this story. So what was your initial interest in this story, and at what point did you realize that you were onto something much bigger?
Yeah, I mean, it started pretty simply. I just wanted to look at Xanax on college campuses, specifically Xanax and fraternities. I was in college the same time as basically all the guys in this book. I was in a fraternity at the same time as all the guys in this book. And when I was in Greek life, I saw a lot of Xanax. I had friends who were dealing, I had friends who were using, I had friends who were dropping out of school. And before school, I kind of thought of Xanax as, I don't know, I mean, something that a parent might take on a flight to Europe or something. But I realized pretty quickly that it was one of the, you know, one or two biggest party drugs in Greek life. And after school, I became an investigative journalist and basically thought, okay, well, how could I write about Xanax as a crime story, not as kind of an eat your vegetables, you know, here's what Xanax is kind of book. And I Googled pretty simply Xanax bust fraternity. And the first result was this article in the Charleston Post and Courier about these guys, KAs and SAEs mostly, who are using pledges to send Xanax pills around. In the article, it said mostly around Charleston. And the article also said something like 44,000 Xanax pills is what they gotten caught with. But then I started doing some research, and a defense lawyer let it slip that it was actually closer to 3 million Xanax pills. And then from there, you know, they also got caught with pounds of cocaine and marijuana, LSD, ketamine, all sorts of, you know, kind of you name it, assault rifles, grenade launcher. And then I started finding, you know, students who had died. And it just turned out to be really a national drug ring, in some ways a global drug ring if you're following the supply chains. And yeah, the story just kind of grew and grew and fractaled out of control from there.
So before we get into the specifics of this story and some of the characters involved, I guess I just missed the seriousness of Xanax, but you do a great job of laying out benzodiazepines and just how popular they've become this century and just some of the consequences of that as well. So for maybe people like myself who aren't quite familiar, who missed that ever so slightly, why is this Xanax and anti-anxiety medication epidemic something that is much more serious than a lot of people realize?
Sure. So yeah, I mean, there are addiction specialists who are now calling it sort of our hidden epidemic, because obviously, rightfully so, a lot of attention has gone to the opiate crisis. But if you look at the statistics, in the same, basically the last 20 years, that opiate overdoses have gone up eightfold, benzodiazepine overdoses have gone up tenfold. And what they're calling it now is a polypharmacy crisis or a polydrug crisis. It's basically the idea that people in my generation, it used to be, I mean, I don't know this because I wasn't there, but what these addiction specialists have told me, and it kind of rings true with talking to my parents and their friends, it used to be you kind of would have one substance and you would stick to that. You'd be like, oh, that guy's a pothead. That guy's a, you know, an alcoholic. That guy, you know, has a heroin problem. But what we have now is kind of mixing and matching and combining. That's really the most common way people in my generation take drugs. It's sort of, you get to this sort of balancing act. What kids at the College of Charleston called it was a sidecar, like the little rig you see on the side of a cartoon motorcycle. And Xanax is an incredibly effective sidecar. It mixes with all sorts of things. You can blend it with cocaine and ease the paranoia, but you can also mix it with, the most common thing to do is you mix it with four or five, domestic light beers, and it feels like you've had 15 or 16 drinks and you black out. And for a lot of guys, that's kind of the goal on a given night. And yeah, I think it's really interesting if you think of the sort of it drugs for different generations. And obviously, we're talking in broad strokes here, but if you think of the 60s, you probably think of smoking weed. Maybe at its most extreme, you think of acid. If you think of the 80s, you're probably thinking of cocaine. I think it says a lot that in my generation, the sort of go-to party drug is an anti-anxiety tranquilizer designed for panic attacks. I think that says a lot about just how much social anxiety is coursing through social life. I think it also has something to do with, like I said, that sort of customization mentality. And then also there's just like this sort of will toward oblivion, like not wanting to feel anything, wanting to black out. And it's powerful stuff.
And you also point out that while it is something that does a great job of taking the edge off initially, people build up a tolerance pretty quickly. So it takes more and more, and this isn't exclusive to Xanax, of course. It takes more and more to get that same effect. But it also, once it gets its hooks into somebody, is very difficult to quit. And I had heard this previously, but it's literally one of two things that if you try to detox from, you can literally die from stopping taking it altogether to go along with alcohol, too.
So yeah, if you try to quit cold turkey, your brain can basically create this sort of electrical storm of activity that causes a seizure and you can die. And that's not even true of heroin. So, I mean, you really are talking about one of the most addictive substances we have. And for whatever reason, there just wasn't, and I would say still isn't, there still isn't much awareness about the damage it can do. And I think a lot of kids who show up to college saying, I would never touch an opiate. I would never even touch cocaine, but Xanax, I mean, my parents took Xanax. How bad could it be? And then it can get pretty wild from there.
All right, so getting into this College of Charleston story now, who are Mikey Schmidt, Rob Liljeberg? How did they initially connect and why did they get along so well so quickly?
The book follows Mikey Schmidt. He's the main character of the book. And he arrived to College of Charleston in 2013. When he got there, he had just finished a 7-inch growth spurt. He was 5'0" up until the end of high school. His voice hadn't changed yet. He was at a pretty classic kind of suburban Atlanta high school. And I think if you're going to be 5'0" and have your voice be as high as the girls in your class, there's a lot of different ways that can go. But for Mikey, he sort of developed this preternatural confidence and swagger to be able to sort of move through the world as a 5 foot nothing person with a single mom. His dad had left his home when he was 3 years old. And finally, he hits this growth spurt. He's still only 5'7", so people still call him Lil Mikey. But he basically entered Greek life fraternity rush at the College of Charleston immediately. And the best fraternities, and we can get into what that means, you usually have to come from pretty serious amounts of wealth, often prep schools, often, this sort of social network that already exists. So that was kind of closed off to him. But he managed to join the sort of mid-tier fraternity, KA. And I think one of the reasons he was able to join is he had this swagger, he had this confidence. He also had a pretty successful fake ID business. It's always a good way to make friends, freshman year. And he sold a little weed as well. And very quickly he met this guy, Rob Liljeberg, who kind of recruited him into the fraternity. Rob comes from an old Southern family out of New Orleans. His grandfather and uncle opened a bunch of hospitals down there. His dad was a surgeon, kind of moving around small towns in the South. And Rob, kind of, when he got to College of Charleston, followed the much more traditional, what used to be called the big man on campus path. He was an Eagle Scout. He was an altar boy. He was a member of the Catholic Students Association. He got recruited to play college soccer and then transferred. But I think when he got to College of Charleston, he realized pretty quickly that there actually isn't much social clout in being an altar boy anymore. And so he pretty quickly kind of changed paths, joined a fraternity, started selling a little weed. And that's when he and Mikey met each other.
So at what point does Xanax enter the equation for these two guys to where they are dealing it amongst themselves and also among their fellow fraternity brothers?
So, yeah, I mean, I think their first year of dealing was mostly weed. There's kind of a long informal tradition in Greek life of dealing weed in fraternities. There's almost always some guy in a chapter who has some supplier, and then he'll pass that supplier to a younger guy when he's graduating. And, you know, they don't even necessarily see themselves as weed dealers. They see themselves as middlemen. You know, it's sort of this thing of like, oh, I'm just buying some and then I'm selling to my boys. Maybe I have a little money for the weekend and I get to smoke for free. I think that's kind of what it was. Mikey had a more active imagination. He played a lot of Grand Theft Auto, which came out that year, watched a lot of The Wire, and he sort of set up their freshman dorm with some of his KA guys. They sort of saw it. They compared it to the projects in the first season, the towers in the first season of The Wire. And they had all these rules of, you know, never have the product in the same room as the money, and as the same room as the buy. And they would, you know, meet in stairwells. And so it sort of started to ramp up that way. But I think it wasn't until they sort of decided they wanted to compete socially with these wealthier fraternities that they got involved in Xanax. So let's say that's about a year into their dealing. And what had sort of really changed, and we can get into this, but the dark web really changed everything about the way drugs are dealt on campus. And so they really stumbled into one of the biggest dark web Xanax operations in America.
Yeah, that was my next question. How did the dark web change things in this regard?
So, yeah, I mean, I think up until, you know, the early 2010s, drug dealing on a college campus, you basically had to have someone who would go to the quote unquote other side of the tracks and meet someone, a supplier who is connected either to a cartel or a gang or some sort of criminal syndicate that controlled the flow of whether it was cocaine, whether it was weed, whether it was whatever. And the barrier to entry for that, you know, that's a little scary. You know, you have to sort of put yourself at risk. And these are people that if you cross, you know, there might be consequences. And so I think it kind of put a natural ceiling on how much drug dealing could occur in Greek life. There was still some, like I said, with the weed dealing. But all of a sudden, with the advent of the dark web, you could order stuff to your dorm room without leaving the safety of campus Wi-Fi. And these guys would get on the dark web. And, you know, I had friends who were doing this. They would get stuff literally shipped to the campus mail center. And you just go down and something a DEA agent told me is at this point, the U.S. Postal Service is the biggest drug trafficker in the world. The Postal Service is just so overburdened that they could never really hope to regulate what's sort of going through the mail. And people will ship all sorts of things. Also, a lot of drug dealers have the sort of harebrained idea that because it's a federal offense to open someone else's, you know, U.S. postal mail, that they're somehow more protected sending it that way. But all that's to say is pretty quickly, these guys realized they could get Xanax pills shipped to their door. And, you know, you're talking about something that's odorless. You're talking about something that's incredibly lightweight. You're talking about something that is a Schedule 4 drug. So if you get caught with it, there's no trafficking charge. And so it seemed like a great deal. And that's not even getting into just how high the demand was. And so, yeah, these guys started shipping it. And then we can get into how it grew from there, but that's kind of how it began.
And so I guess at this point we need to bring another character into this story, and that would be a guy named Zachary Kligman.
Yeah.
Who was Zachary Kligman, and why does he enter the picture as it pertains to Xanax?
So, yeah, I mean, a lot of the guys who met Zachary Kligman for the first time really underestimated him. He was kind of he was about Mikey's size, 5'6", 5'7". He weighed, you know, 125 pounds, like mostly knees and elbows. He was a long boarder. He listened to a lot of Bass Nectar. He was kind of like the southern coastal hippie, you know, widespread panic guy you might meet in a town like Charleston. His parents owned a gag gift shop in Myrtle Beach. Very different than the kind of people you'd see around, an SAE or even a KA party. But those who knew him as the Charleston Kingpin. And he was actually bringing in the bulk of Xanax pills into Charleston. There was a DEA interview where he claimed he basically could supply most of Charleston by himself, which seemed like hyperbole, but later turned out to be pretty true. But basically, he was part of this organization. All college age guys, some former fraternity members, they were shipping in alprazolam powder from southern China via the dark web. It would go through this guy in Montreal who would pack it in printer cartridges, ship it down to Charleston. And these guys would rent a different beach house every month off the coast of Charleston. And they would set up an industrial pill press inside these beach houses. And they could make a few hundred thousand pills a month. They would wear Tyvek suits because the amount of alprazolam dust that the pill press was kicking up would get you permabarred. You'd basically get covered in this dust, and you could black out on that alone. And they would make hundreds of thousands of these pills, and then they had a few different things they would do. They would empty out Skittles bags and then put Xanax pills in them and heat seal the Skittles bags and ship them on the dark web all over the US under the name Genius Bar, which is like a pun on people call Xanax bars because of their shape. But then they would also give them to Zach Klingman, who had a secret compartment in the back of his black Cadillac, and he would drive in hundreds of thousands of pills, ultimately millions of pills, into Charleston and sell them on consignment to often these fraternity guys who would then basically blast the pills out around the southeast to other fraternity houses. And you basically had this pretty massive distribution network.
Yeah, and this does end up involving Mikey Schmidt to a much larger degree as well. And I forget the exact timeline. It was sometime after his first year at College of Charleston, but he does ultimately leave college and move back home to Atlanta. How did that change things for him, not just as a drug dealer, but also as just a human being living on this planet? Because, man, he started to live a drastically different life at that point.
Yeah, so I think Mikey had a little too much fun freshman year, dealing weed. He tried Xanax. It's a school where you can easily go out 6 nights a week. Some guys go out seven. And so into freshman year, he's back living at home in the Atlanta suburbs with a very unhappy mom and stepfather. And they basically tell him, you need to get a job. And so he sort of works his connections, and through KA, one of his KA brothers' fathers owned a big nightclub in Atlanta called the Tongue and Groove. And so, Mikey, he's 18. He can't even necessarily go inside the nightclub, although, of course, he does have good fake IDs. He gets a job working valet outside. And at first, he hates it. People are throwing dollar bills at him, and he's seeing all these Lamborghinis pull up, and, famous people, Justin Bieber, and all the Atlanta rappers are getting out of the car. And he doesn't even get to park their cars. But eventually, because of this sort of charm he has, people start calling him Lil Mikey, and he gets on the VIPs. And so he's a special VIP parker, and he starts to meet people, and he starts to drop little sample bags of weed into people's cup holders with his card. So he starts to get this reputation. And then one night, this guy named Wilson Warren, who goes by Biscuit, he used to be Justin Bieber's kind of manager, body man, very connected in Atlanta nightlife, shows up drunk and pulls a gun on Mikey and tells him to park the car. Mikey, sort of as a prank, steals some Xanax out of Biscuit's cup holder. And this friendship between Mikey and Biscuit is born. And next thing you know, Mikey basically enters the Atlanta rap scene. Biscuit was managing the 808 Mafia, which were making a lot of the biggest sort of trap singles of the early 2010s. And next thing you know, he's in a recording studio with Young Thug and all these kind of Future and your really big names. And within a year, he's bringing cartel grade cocaine from Atlanta to fraternity houses around the Southeast, and then picking up this Xanax from the Kligman Liljeburg network. And bringing that back down through these fraternity houses back to Atlanta. He has a really nice condo in this the kind of fanciest area of Atlanta. He has a condo in Charleston. He's got four cars, and he's, well known in most of the strip clubs between, down I-95, and yeah, his life changed very quickly.
So there's a group of rappers who became renowned for doing the fraternity circuit, going and performing at fraternity houses across the South and across the country to a lesser degree. And that included Waka Flocka Flame, right? Who Mikey ultimately becomes pretty close with and actually further endears him with his former KA brethren at College of Charleston, too.
Yeah, it's a funny sort of cycle. Like he left College of Charleston, was sort of excommunicado for a minute, and then by the time he's back, he's there with Waka Flocka Flame, with a bunch of cartel cocaine, and knowing all these dealers, and it really was in a very short period of time. But yeah, his a lot of people speculate on his relationship with Waka Flocka Flame. A lot of the guys in KA told me, they're like, oh yeah, Waka released a song where he says, my plug is a white boy, and everyone swears it's Mikey Schmidt. And I think we'll never know. There's obviously a lot of smoke and mirrors and all of that stuff. And I'm certainly would never be one to point at rap lyrics as a prosecutor, as something we've seen in the last few years. But yeah, Mikey was in, he was in pretty deep.
When, why, and how did Coke become a part of Mikey, Rob, and Zach's business?
The simplest way it was described to me is that sort of sidecar experience. The sort of balancing act of if you're mixing weed, booze, and Xanax, those are three downers. And so the sort of way you level that out and keep going is cocaine. And I think it's a pretty classic thing you see in Greek life and just sort of party system generally is, freshman year, you're mostly seeing drinking and smoking. Sophomore year, sometimes Xanax enters the system. And it's often the upperclassmen who are, in someone's fraternity bedroom or bathroom or doing cocaine junior year. And then by senior year, it's just out on like the coffee tables. And I think that's certainly what happened here. It's much harder to find a cocaine source than really anything else. It's not that hard to get good Xanax on the dark web, but cocaine is still kind of that last thing, like I was saying, where you do need to get in touch with a criminal syndicate. And Mikey, being in Atlanta, really had no problem doing that. His source was someone he called Uncle. Some people say it was his actual uncle. Mikey's dad had left home when Mikey was, three or four, in connection to cocaine and drug trafficking, or at least that's what Mikey said. That's a very hard thing to track down. His dad kind of has, yeah, basically been MIA since then. But all that's to say, Mikey had this link to getting very high quality cocaine at decent prices, and pretty soon had worked out a whole system using kind of fraternity pledges to, traffic it around the southeast.
Yeah, this turns into a very intricate system and a lucrative system too. You point out that Rob's last year of college, these guys are actually having to launder money. They have so much cash on hand. How were they going about doing that?
So I mean, there's stuff on the recorded phone calls that sort of happened in the end, where they're talking pretty explicitly about laundering it through fraternity slush fund. And I was able to track down some sources that confirmed that, yeah, that basically they were able to basically cook the fraternity books. So, certain fundraising things, certain parties, it was really all a way of washing this drug money. And then, they would also invest in real estate. It was the laundering stuff was pretty interesting. The guy who was running a lot of those pill presses, his name was Eric Hughes. He was the first person in American history to have Bitcoin seized by the DEA, and ultimately, amassed something like $30 or $40 million in Bitcoin. Obviously, a lot of that was just watching Bitcoin go like this, but even so, that's real money.
Yes, it is. And so this is where the story gets even more interesting, as if what we've talked about hasn't been interesting enough. The police ultimately do end up on their trails. Anybody who knows this story from the headlines understands this whole racket gets busted before it's all said and done. So how did police initially end up on the trail of this drug trafficking network and these guys involved?
See, I mean, for a long time, it seemed like no one would get caught because a fraternity house is kind of a perfect setting for drug dealing. You're basically within this closed system where everyone has excess income. No one knows the price of anything. There's a sworn culture of secrecy. And the only policeman nearby is a campus cop on a golf cart with a flashlight. And so the ring just grew and grew and grew. And, you know, guys were telling me like, oh, yeah, I could show up to one house. There'd be 40 customers in the same building. And I could, you know, make $15,000 in 45 minutes. And I would just go from house to house to house down Greek Row. And really, if you look at the police files, the police had no idea any of this was going on until on the first Friday of spring break 2016, one of the boys in the drug ring, his name is Patrick Moffley. He came from a prominent South Carolina family. His dad was a big time real estate developer. His mom had run for Congress. She was on the Charleston School Board. He lived on a massive equestrian farm on a place that was actually called Paradise Island. And he was one of the people that would bag up the Xanax for the ring and heat seal it in the Skittles. And he also would take cocaine to fraternity tailgates. He was very involved in the ring. But anyway, on the first Friday of spring break, 2016, police found him shot on the floor of his campus apartment. He was holding a Chipotle napkin to the bullet hole in his chest, and his body was surrounded by hundreds of these counterfeit Xanax pills. They were all marked GG249. And all of a sudden, this became a massive news story. And it was sort of two questions. It was who killed Patrick Moffley? And then how on earth, you know, did this kid get involved in this drug ring where he would be found surrounded by hundreds of counterfeit Xanax pills? Where did these pills come from? And next to Patrick's body, they also found a lease agreement to a stash house, I mean, sort of down the road. And so when they started looking where these pills came from, they found the stash house. And Zach Kligman, the Charleston kingpin, they found there was a hidden camera showing him cleaning out the stash house 15 minutes after Patrick died. So they knew there was some connection there. And basically they just started working informants, just one after another. These boys started flipping on each other, wearing wires on each other, recording each other, giving full DEA proffers. And pretty quickly the FBI gets involved, the DEA gets involved, the US Postal Service finally gets involved. They do have an investigative wing. Of course, Charleston Police has a massive task force. And through these betrayals, basically these boys kept setting up controlled buys with each other. So they would call and say, hey, I want to buy this. The police are listening in. The police are staking out. The purchase happens and the police swarm in. And this continued and continued until it finally reached Rob Liljeburg and Mikey.
Yeah, we're going to put a pin in that murder, come back to that here in just a few minutes. But speaking of Rob and Mikey, arguably the two closest of anybody who are part of this network, but that changes significantly, even if one of them didn't realize it in the moment. So what exactly happened, according to your excellent reporting, by the way, because we will also talk about you speaking with Mikey from jail, not having any luck with Rob, and being offered answers for $150 by one of the other witnesses here. But what did happen on April 22nd, 2016?
So yeah, for about a month, Zach Kligman had kind of been asking Rob for about a pound and a half of cocaine. And Rob kept saying, I'm going to get it from my source in Atlanta. And there was this massive delay. You know, they sent one pledge driver to pick up the cocaine from Mikey, and Mikey dropped his phone from a 20-story building. They sent another, but he had exams. And it was just this sort of, the tension continued to build. But finally, Mikey met one of these pledge drivers at a Publix grocery store outside Atlanta and did their classic handoff technique, which was basically heat sealed cocaine and pills inside groceries, put in a grocery bag. Very simple. The boy drove the groceries back to Charleston. gave them to Rob Liljeberg, who sold them to Zach Kligman. Rob did not realize that Zach, his Cadillac had a camera rigged up in it. He was wearing a wire. And so Rob sells him the yay, as they called it. And when Zach drives away, SWAT team sort of swarms onto Rob's house. They had this $1 million, you know, sort of 200-year-old mansion close to the campus where they were living, and SWAT team swarmed in, and there are also all these plainclothes guys who are dressing like people do in that neighborhood. So, you know, salmon shorts and golf polos, but they were actually policemen. And but while all this is happening, Mikey's in Atlanta and he has no idea. And immediately they bring in Rob. Rob and Mikey are best friends. Rob, you know, was the only person who showed up to Mikey's grandfather, who was really a surrogate father's funeral. If you read their text together, it's just constantly, you know, I love you. And they were really, really close. But immediately Rob is given the choice, you know, 25-year minimum, or you tell me where you got that cocaine. And before he even called a lawyer, he actually didn't even call a lawyer that day. He just gave up everything. He gave them a list of all of the names of everyone in KA who was involved, everyone in the other fraternities who was involved, and a bunch of information on Mikey. But of course, that wasn't enough. They said, we want you to continue to talk to Mikey and get him to admit to everything. And so Rob basically had to charm Mikey over the next month into, because Mikey was very paranoid because no, he had never been paid for this deal. And Rob had to be like, it was Zach Kligman hasn't paid me back. Zach got arrested. I didn't get arrested. It was all this sort of obfuscation. And
well, and there were also people in Charleston saying, hey, something weird happened on April 22nd involving Rob, where he gets arrested and he walks back through the door 3 hours later just saying his passport got taken.
Exactly. He shows back up in his street clothes. But, you know, Rob is very true. Because, yeah, Mikey would say, like, people are telling me you're a snitch. And Rob, he had all these very charming ways. He would be like, well, you would know if I was a snitch. You're the most connected person I know. And so, like, if you're not hearing it, it can't be true. And then, you know, you try another line of sort of, if I had gotten caught with what you sent me, you know, I would be in jail for 30 years right now. Like, how would I be in street clothes drinking a Corona? And how would I be sending you a photo of the cocaine that I'm selling right now? And he also kind of tried subservience. He'd be like, I'm your pledge. You know, I owe you money. I'm going to work off. You can go on the beach and drink a Corona while I earn you money. But basically what he had to do is he had to lure Mikey back to Charleston so he could be arrested. And ultimately he did that by, Rob was allowed to graduate from College of Charleston, even though he'd been arrested with, you know, a pound and a half of cocaine and Xanax pills and weed and all sorts of other things. He was allowed to graduate. And so he said, my family has an extra ticket for you and your mother to graduation. I would love if you came. And so Mikey shows up. His mom didn't end up making the trip, but Mikey came. And they had this beer on a rooftop in Charleston, this deep heart-to-heart where they talked through everything. And when Mikey went downstairs, he went to go meet his lawyer. When Rob went downstairs, he went to take off his wire and give it to the police. He had recorded the whole conversation. And the next day, the police swarm in and arrest Mikey. And it wasn't until then that Mikey realized that he had been betrayed the whole time, and every conversation he had had with Rob for the past month had been recorded.
How much of a deal did Rob end up getting for flipping on his friend?
He ended up serving about a little over 2 years in what's called a Youthful Offender Act prison. It's something they have in South Carolina. It's sort of between juvie and an adult prison. It's kind of for young adolescents. Or, you know, older adolescents, 18 to 22. Rob was actually like 27 at the time, but that was just kind of the good deal he got. But yeah, he's now completely free, and we can get into this, but ultimately Mikey is the only one in the entire basically extended ring who's in prison.
Yeah, and what he ends up cutting a deal too, by the way, even though he is still in jail. What was the deal versus what he might have been facing had he taken things to trial?
If he'd taken things to trial, he'd be facing exactly what Rob would have faced, which is that 25-year minimum. And instead, he got 10 years without parole.
And so he's, I believe, in year six of that prison term. And you were actually able to get in touch with him while in jail. How difficult a process was this? And what were you able to learn just from being able to speak with him on a number of different occasions?
Yeah, so I mean, it was a very difficult process at first. The prison wasn't allowing visitors who didn't know him previously. Then COVID lockdown happened. And I was just very much getting stonewalled and kind of was getting used to the idea that this whole book would be what journalists call write around, which is you just try to interview as many people as you know who knew the main source but never talked to the main source. And then out of the blue, one of Mikey's best friends texted me a phone number, and he said, "This number is Mikey, by the way." And I didn't know what that meant. I was like, oh, is it the prison number or something? I called it a very sort of low baritone answer. And I was like, okay, well, that's not Mikey. And I said, I'm looking to speak to Mikey, please. And he said, 1 second, and handed it over. It turned out it was a black market cell phone that had been smuggled into jail. And Mikey and I spoke. He was obviously very afraid. You know, he said, first, one of the first things he said is, I'm very paranoid about phones. I've been betrayed on the phone before by my best friend. So it took a long time to sort of earn his trust. But over the next years, he had a series of black market cell phones smuggled in. And there were times where we were talking, you know, 3 or 4 times a week. We've talked at this point, I don't know, probably over 100 hours of conversations. And
wow. Okay.
Kind of constantly texting. And he's only one of 124 sources in the book. And that's not even including the thousands of pages of police files, court documents, you know, first and primary and secondary sources. But in terms of getting to know his point of view, you know, there's really no more valuable engine for a journalist than like that sort of in-depth conversation.
Are you still in contact with him, or because the story is over, that's kind of it for your relationship with Mikey?
No, I mean, I definitely will still be in contact with him. He doesn't have one of those cell phones anymore. Mm. You know, I think he's trying to walk the straight and narrow just in terms of, you know, wanting to not have his sentence extended.
Not getting caught with contraband, you mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Cause you know, he'd also been caught with some contraband weed, and, you know, I think it's just now he's sort of like, okay, I'm over halfway done. Let's just get this over. But yeah, absolutely. When he's out, I plan on, you know, seeing him. And it's a complicated thing, right? Cause you know, it's a journalist source relationship, and I had to make it very clear, like, we're not friends. And, you know, anything you tell me on the records, you know, can go in the book, and there's no, like, I'm going to do you a favor or something. But once the book's over and you realize you've had just the depth of these conversations and you've gotten to know, especially the sort of suffering he's gone through in prison and everything with his family, of course, I mean, you if you're human, you end up caring about someone. And so once the book's over and you can kind of put it away, then you can sort of be like, okay, well, how can I help this person re-enter society and all of that?
The amount of sources that you established, Mikey included, is impressive. And the legwork that you did too, by the way, talking about reading police files, reading through text message exchanges, you listened to recordings as well. There were only a handful of people that you weren't able to get in touch with, as far as I know. And Rob is one of those people too, correct? And that's not a result of you not trying.
No, I mean, Rob was the main person that I would have done anything to speak to and didn't speak. You know, I spoke to his lawyer multiple times, you know, ex-girlfriends, so many of his friends, basically every single one of his roommates. But, you know, he didn't want to speak. And I understand why. I mean, it's it has to be an incredibly painful memory. And then the fact that memory ends with him making the very tough decision to you know, cooperate with the police and turn in his friend, his best friend. I can understand why he would hope this just kind of goes away. But it's always a fascinating game theory thing, right? Because it's, as a source, it's like, if you talk to a journalist, sometimes you're making your role in the story bigger and you want to minimize your role, so you don't want to speak to a journalist. But then at some point, if a journalist has already spoken to 120 other people, then you have 120 people talking about you, but you don't get to give your own side. And so that's what I kept trying to give Rob a chance to do is just like, hey, I you know, I know what all these other people said about you, but I want to know what you have to say about you. But of course, that's just his choice. And, you know, I do definitely understand it.
Yeah, it's a tough one, but I think a lot of people would. If you're staring down the barrel of 25 years in federal penitentiary for drug trafficking and more, to give yourself a little bit of relief, even if it means taking down a good friend. I mean, that is an unfortunate Sophie's choice for anybody who has to make that one. And we're going to go back to Patrick Moffley's murder now. Yeah. It happened March 4th, 2016, as we already discussed. And there were some very strange things surrounding this murder, including him still being alive when police got there. And one of the last things that he uttered, or maybe the last thing that he uttered, police asked him who did it. He said the names Jordan Piacente and Dollar T robbed me. Yeah. What did that mean?
So, yeah, I mean, police had no idea what that meant in the moment. But, of course, they quickly started interviewing everyone at the house, everyone who knew Patrick. And Jordan Piacente was a student who he had sort of dated on and off. And Dollar T was a very small time Xanax dealer from the sort of the other side of Charleston, you know, across the river, West Ashley, who Patrick had met at the Silver Dollar Bar, and he went by T, so he called him Dollar T. And very quickly they honed in on Dollar T. There was a witness outside the house that said she saw three black men jump into a red Volkswagen Jetta and drive away. And the red Jetta had dealer tags, so they found out where the Jetta came from. And something I didn't know until going to this murder trial, if you buy or lease, as it were, a car at a place that often sells to people with, you know, lower credit scores, what they do is they secretly put a tracker in these cars. And so a lot of people are driving around cars that they don't know they're being tracked. But every time they stop or start the car, a little thing is going back to the dealership telling them where they are. And police can subpoena this. And so very quickly, they were able to find Dollar T, Charles Mungin, find out that he had sent text messages to set up this Xanax purchase from Patrick that day for 10,000 pills. And that was basically it for them. Jordan Piacente was able to show she was in New York the day of the murder. At first, she said she was going for a baptism, and then she said she was going for a wedding, or vice versa. Her phone ended up falling into the Atlantic Ocean, so the DEA couldn't look into it. But basically, they were only interested in who was at the crime scene at the time, and they knew Charles Mungin was there. There's no evidence that he pulled the trigger. Policemen even told me they don't think he pulled the trigger. But there's something called the hand of one, hand of all principle, both in South Carolina and federal law. And it's basically, if you and I robbed a Chase Bank together this afternoon in Austin, and you were the getaway driver, and I went out and, you know, got a little crazy and shot the bank teller, I got in the car and you had no idea that I had done that. It doesn't matter. Just by being complicit in the robbery, you're now complicit in the murder, and you can be tried for murder as if you went in and killed him yourself. And that's probably what happened to Charles. He was offered a plea deal of 12 years for manslaughter, but because he, you know, believed, because I didn't do this, why would I go to jail? He went to trial and he ended up getting life plus 30 years. And so with no chance of parole.
Why is it possible that Zach Kligman could have had a role in all of this too?
So yeah, a lot of people in the book, a lot of Patrick's family and friends told me they believed, they had told police that they thought Zach might have something to do with it. When Patrick, a month before Patrick died, or a few months before he died, he had been arrested at a tailgate for University of South Carolina football game with a trafficking level of cocaine. And he was scaling it out on the, you know, the dash of a truck. The campus policeman saw him. Next thing you know, he's in handcuffs. Next thing you know, he's looking at, a very long prison sentence for trafficking cocaine. And his parents hired him the best lawyer in sort of the upcountry South Carolina. And there was the chance that Patrick would have to say where that cocaine came from, the same decision Rob made to lessen his prison sentence. That cocaine, it seems it came from Zach Kligman. Zach tried to hire a lawyer for Patrick to sort of control the defense. Patrick's parents said no. And Patrick basically went into hiding for 2 months at his parents' farm on Paradise Island, having cocaine withdrawals, panic attacks, a depressive episode, and basically saying, Zach Klinkman's going to think I'm a rat and he's going to come after me. He's got big bad enforcers. He's got people who can get you fucked up, was his quote. Or, people told me he was afraid he would kill him. And on March 3rd, his roommates said, Patrick, you need to pay this electric bill. So his dad sends him with a check into Charleston. The next day, Patrick's dead. And so I think a lot of people, their theory was, Zach thought that Patrick was going to rat on him. And so he sent his enforcers. And, the next day, Patrick's dead. And then you look at the camera footage, 15 minutes later, and Zach is cleaning out this stash house. That was a theory that a lot of people told me. From defense lawyers to Patrick's immediate family, his parents, siblings, some people who dealt with Patrick, also some people who were in the drug ring. Ultimately, as a journalist, you don't want to just put out, accuse someone of murder. It's a massive accusation. And ultimately, I do think this feels more like a drug robbery gone wrong. If you look at the specifics of the murder, Patrick was upstairs with these three guys. They pulled a gun on him. Patrick's arm was broken, so they thought he wouldn't fight back. But the roommates heard basically a fist fight rolling down the stairs. When they got downstairs, you hear someone saying, you heard Patrick saying, "Are you really going to shoot me?" Gunshot, pills fall everywhere. And then the three guys sprint out with whatever pills they could pick up. There was a girlfriend in Charles' car who basically said in sworn testimony that they were freaking out as if that was not the plan at all. So I'm not going to sit here and say that I think Zach Kligman put out a hit on Patrick Moffley. I think that would be very irresponsible from as a journalist. But it was also my job, because so many people believed that, to show that the police really didn't look into that theory at all. And I think that's there were still a lot of people in Patrick's life who were very upset about that.
Yeah, and it's not just the fact that they didn't even humor that theory. It's the fact that there were a couple of other very strange things that happened surrounding Zach that weren't ever really accounted for.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, police, when they busted Zach through a storage locker that he had, they found millions of Xanax pills in this storage locker. And again, he's potentially a suspect or a secondary suspect in a murder, but he wasn't charged for the pills, which they underreported by 8,000%. You reported, never considered a suspect in the murder, and he escaped serious punishment on several other issues too. You could never really figure why that was, though. I mean, there's only so much that cutting a deal can get in terms of targeting other people. Is that something that you still wonder about to this day? Because that is curious to the point where you just wonder. Just who he or his parents might know in the highest of levels.
Yeah, I mean, I think he really has dodged, an incredible amount of bullets even before he got to Charleston. You can look at his arrest record, up in Myrtle Beach, in Georgia, getting arrested with real felony quantities of basically every drug you can think of, on a trafficking level, and never doing a day of jail time. And in fact, those things never going to trial. There's something called the Whitey Bulger hypothesis in criminology, and it's based off this the Boston criminal kingpin Whitey Bulger, who The Departed is kind of based off of, and there have been a few other movies based off his life. And basically, this guy was at the very top of the Boston mob. He was also an FBI informant, and he basically would use the FBI to arrest his rivals, to arrest ambitious people under him in his own organization, to arrest people basically he wanted to get rid of in his organization. And when you're using the guy on top to arrest people below the guy on top, really, who's working for who? In a sense, it's a capture hypothesis. The FBI was working for Whitey Bulger. And because if you think of, you know, the usual corkboard and something like The Wire or something, it's like, okay, we flip the small-time dealer who then can get us to the mid-level supplier. And then we put the screws on the mid-level supplier and say, we need, you know, you're going to go to jail for life unless you can go on the stand and say that Avon Barksdale is your, you know, your boss. And that's the way it works. But if you have the guy on top, an informant already, what's really going on there? And so I think, for instance, Mikey's lawyer's argument was, okay, so you have this guy who got caught with 3 million Xanax pills and all these other things, the grenade launcher included, and every drug on the list. And yet it's the sort of mid-level guys that he's putting in prison, guys who got caught with significantly less than 3 million pills. But ultimately, you know, Zach got away with a lot, but so did almost everyone else in this book. Like, you know, as of now, Mikey's the only one in prison. And KA got kicked off campus for 4 years. They're back. SAE never left campus at all. And you can go on. I was thinking the other day, if I ever was speaking to a journalism school and wanted to talk about sort of the limits of what investigative journalism could do, I would just pull up the CFC SAE Instagram. It's still public. And after the book came out, both CFC, KA, and SAE are just posting absolutely wild parties. Like, to this day, on a public Instagram page, after a book came out, you know, detailing how they're part of a, you know, a multi-million dollar drug trafficking network with murders and student deaths and all the rest. But Zach is, in that sense, he's sort of just an example of how many of these guys get away with everything.
Damn shame. And you actually did have one encounter that I'm aware of, an in-person encounter with Zach, who was working at his parents' beach tchotchke shop in Myrtle Beach. What's your lasting impression from that interaction, Max?
I mean, he was incredibly charming. I could tell he was incredibly, this, you know, at first, just incredibly warm, kind of brings you in his embrace. Like I say, he seems like the least threatening person on earth. The second he found out I was a journalist, it was this very sophisticated thing where he was like shaking, and you feel his fear. So you feel like he's threatened by you. And so you have this idea in your mind, but then like he was asking very intelligent sort of targeted questions about my investigation, what I knew about the Moffley murder. And really, like, I thought I was interviewing him to an extent. He was getting more information out of me. I think he's a very bright person. And I mean, you don't run a multi-million dollar network without, a lot of guile.
And he made sure to ask if they caught the murderers of Moffley too.
Yeah. And you know, he told me, Zach said that Patrick was one of his best friends. And, I don't know if that's true. You know, I guess we'll never know.
All right, you've passed the final exam for the book that you wrote and did such a phenomenal job on. So congratulations on this book once again. Just as somebody who's a nerd for investigative journalism who reads a lot of books, how cool is it to have quotes from Buzz Bissinger, Skip Hollandsworth, and Rick McDonnell talking about how great this book is?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's an insane life moment for sure. It'll be hard to live up to something like that in the second book, but we'll see what happens.
That leads me to, I guess, what's my final question? What's next?
See, I mean, right now I'm putting a proposal together for the next book and talking to Sony about the adaptation for this book. And so they've adapt. They've optioned it and they had someone write a screenplay, but they're kind of trying to figure out what to do next with that screenplay. So we're kind of talking about that.
I know you need to keep the details of book number two close to your vest, but is it going to be in the true crime realm once again?
I don't think so. You
Okay.
know, you never know what crime you'll sort of stumble on. I can say it's set in the world of EDM, electronic dance music, and there are plenty of crimes there if you want them. So I guess we'll see what I stumble out
The
upon.
drug-fueled world for sure. Well, Max, thank you so much for the time today. This has been a real pleasure. I loved this book. I'm glad that my attention was called to it because there are a lot of great books out there now. So to be able to read this and help you promote it as well, a guy who is also local here in the Austin area is a real treat. So for anybody who is listening right now and is curious to read more, look, even though we got into some of the details, we barely scratched the surface of the excellent writing by Max Marshall in the book Among the Bros, a fraternity crime story. You can get it now wherever books are sold. Max, thank you so much for the time today, and best of luck with things in the future. Hopefully, when that movie adaptation comes out or book number two comes out, we can talk again.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Thanks to Gentleman Jesus for the intro and outro music. Hear more of his work at gentlemanjesus.com. Thanks to you for hanging out. For more of the show and to connect on social media, visit booksonpod.com. We'll talk to you next time on Books on Pod.